Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. I'm the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
Well, you don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I'd like to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'll come down to Anfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
That might be, you know, aiming for utopia, but that is the way I am. I'm a little bit stupid regarding this type of thing. I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
Richie,
God.
How are we feeling this morning?
I just watched the goal set to the Titanic music and it really works. Oh, it really, really works. I think this is the most fun we're ever going to have in the podcast.
I don't want to get into a water war.
I don't want to get into a water war.
It's good, isn't it? There's a party.
You might remember Alan Ferns.
Did you remember Alan Ferns? Red haired guy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Me and Alan Ferns had a fight once in the Guinness swimming pool dressing room.
Oh, Watling Street there.
Frasier and Allie in another incarnation when they were both young, and I guess I was too.
Reverend Jesse Jackson, you're very welcome to the show.
Well, a few people resist publicly. He cast a light to lit up our pathway.
30 million watched the fight.
What?
Yes, that's true. I was better known in Africa than I was in
it's
Ireland.
It's unbelievable.
He threw a hair dryer, I think, at David Beckham in the... Is that right?
No.
So I had this weird thing where I was always the same weight as my age.
Holy shit, Kenan Murphy, it's US Murphy. Round of applause for US Murphy. Yes, that's him.
Kehoe's, right? Upstairs at Kehoe's.
Kehoe's, everyone, but that's right. Fine.
Oh, my word. Tell us, talk us through that, Steve. I think we know what's happened, but talk us through it.
Oh, just saying. Sig Thorsen is the only...
Oh my God.
Fair to say anybody could have managed those guys?
No, of course not.
He was about 12. Everyone in the city knew about him, but no one had seen him. Look how happy I was. What the fuck happened? No, really. What happened?
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Oh, I'm not going to lie. I've got a little bit of the first day at school feeling going on here. Extremely excited, Murph and Ken, and a little bit nervous at the same time. Hello and welcome to the Second Captain's Football Podcast, the World Service. Is live.
Hello there, Owen, and hello everyone.
I don't know you.
A bit Martin Tyler-y of me there, wasn't it?
Well, I was actually only watching it, watching Sky yesterday, and his And It's Live is getting better with every passing year. His pre-Chelsea Burnley And It's Live yesterday was
a masterpiece.
It was absolutely spectacular.
You can get onto a brand new version of secondcaptains.com to get involved in the World Service. I can only hope this all goes better than my actual first day at school. Oh, did I ever on, tell on. You about?
No, well, what happened?
Well, actually, sorry, my very first school was boys and girls together until first class, and then I went to into an all-boys primary school from second class.
Okay.
So what age are you going to second class?
Seven,
that kind of age. My mother spent the entire weekend walking me up and down the route from our house to the school so that I'd be familiar with. She had to go and work on Monday mornings. Mm-hmm. So she thought, well, he's old enough now that he should be able to walk this fairly undemanding and directly straight line to the school.
Yeah.
Yeah, I pretty much freaked out, got lost, didn't know where I was going, and had to have pity taken upon me by the parent of another child who eventually walked me to the school.
It's a bit like a less extreme version of that movie, Lion. Good movie, actually, Aaron. Yeah. It's about an Indian boy who gets lost some 1,700 kilometres from home and ends up in Tasmania.
If you substitute kilometres for feet, then you've got some better understanding of what Owen went through.
Well, today certainly seems to be going better so far. Loads of you have already got down to business and signed up. A big, massive second captain's. Can you do a hug over a podcast?
Get in here, everybody. Let the big bear get his paws on you.
Big second captain's hug for you for doing that. As we said, it is going to be up to you to make this work, and you've been brilliant so far. It's been great. Carol Smurf says she is pledged to second captain's, in inverted commas. The last pledge I took was a confirmation booze pledge. Mm. Here's hoping this one goes better.
So someone was calling himself an arts patron as well.
Yeah.
Which I also liked. A patron of the arts.
Owen Callanan is all signed up with no issues. The excitement about which Ken Early's drawing I'm going to receive is building nicely. Well, you're not on your own there, Owen. There's a lot of excitement around that one. If you do have any issues signing up, by the way, just email members@secondcaptains.com. That's members, plural, @secondcaptains.com, or tweet us @secondcaptains and let us know what the issue is. We will get it sorted for you. If you happen to take a week off last week and you've no idea what the hell I'm talking about, today is launch day of the Second Captains World Service. It's a member-led independent online station. It's going to give you the chance to listen to all your favourite Second Captains podcasts every day of the week. Two pods on a Monday, like this one you're listening to right now, and then one every day from Tuesday. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, to Friday. Membership costs €5 a month plus VAT, depending where in the world you're listening from. And as well as the podcasts, all the podcasts you can handle, you'll also get a Second Captains induction pack, I should say. It includes the aforementioned Kennedy Doodle, priority notice for all live shows, members only events, discounts on everything in the Second Captain shop, Second Captain's badge. Did I mention Richie Sadler's new show? Have I mentioned this?
No.
Okay, where are my manners? Maybe it's because I'm slightly concerned about how well it's going to go, and
this hot
might
breath.
Be the
hot breath on your neck.
The anchor around here. It's the Player's Chair with Richie Sadler. It'll debut this week as part of the World Service. And I think you'll agree he's done pretty well for guest number one. It's only the manager of the moment in the Premier League. Richie met his former teammate Sean Dyche in Dublin today, discussing all manner of things, including how he deals with players who have a bit of a reputation. We're thinking one in particular.
Where does a player like Joey Barton fit into a conversation like this? Because a lot of people, I think, were struck by how things went for him at Glasgow Rangers, and then for you to pick up the phone and to give him a ring and to sign him in the way that you did. I've read it many, many times that so many other managers would not have made that call or signed a player like that. Why did you?
You know, I don't want to judge anyone. So where he's gone elsewhere, other things that have happened to him, and not they're not for me to decide on. I can only speak about him and me at Burnley Football Club. And I mean it sincerely. A lot of people use this term. They say, how have you managed him? I haven't managed him. I've just spoken to him. He's a man. He's not a boy. I say it all the time. But people think there's this magic dust of management. There's not. But if you go back to what we were talking about, or what I was suggesting, if you respond to people on key core values, if he knows I'm going to be honest with him, he knows I'm going to give him the truth, he knows that I'm going to speak to him and listen, well, it's not a bad start point. So with him, I just found that's the way of doing it. So not actually sort of managing him, just speaking to him and almost involving him in the process, but he knows where the line is. All of my lads know where the line is, and they know that clearly. There's a defined moment when they know enough is enough.
Oh, I love that voice. If Sean Dyche tells me where the line is, I agree that I now recognise where that line is.
It's just very gravelly post-match. It's not quite as gravelly there.
Oh, that's pretty gravelly.
I know. Listen, Owen. I mean, we're splitting hairs here. But I think it is after a full... And he does shout a lot on the sideline. Mm. I mean, anytime the camera pans to Sean Dyche, he's roaring something at the absolute top of his voice. So, I mean, you know, post-match you're getting some serious gravel.
It is one area in which the technological revolution in football hasn't yet made its presence felt. Mm. Voice, sideline voice amplification.
Headsets, you know? Do we still haven't yet graduated to an in-ear...
Oh, you mean the players actually?
Sideline to manager...
It might be a bit dangerous. They'd have to use some more conventional application amplification technology, a megaphone through which Deitch could bark orders. I mean, I don't know. I'd sign up.
To hear the Players' Chair with Richie Sadler and his first guest, Sean Dyche, later this week. And to get all the rest of the shows from Tuesday through Friday from now on, just go to secondcaptains.com to become part of this thing. You'll be able to listen to all the shows on your podcast app. There's a little explainer page on secondcaptains.com which shows you how to input your own RSS feed into your podcast player. It's all very straightforward. But again, if there are any problems at all, just tweet us or email members@secondcaptains.com. If none of that's your bag, it's no problem at all. You can still get the two Monday shows regardless. Let's report on some sport, Ken. There's a lot of it.
Well, I wanna, there is a lot to report on. And what is a little bit unusual is a lot of Irish goal kings today. Mm. Kings of the goal, I suppose.
Kings of the goal.
None more so than this young man.
It's Brady. Oh, it's brilliant. Robbie Brady announces himself as a Burnley player in spectacular fashion.
What a strike. Courtois didn't even smell it.
I think Jamie Carragher sounded enthusiastic enough there about Robbie Brady. Very fine goal. Ran to the corner flag, slid to the corner flag, got up out of the slide, used his slide momentum to actually get up out of the slide. This is a man who knows his way around a knee slide.
He loves a good knee slide.
In that fairness, conditions were pretty much perfect.
Yeah, but he knows how to adapt to the conditions, Murph. Same thing in Sarajevo. Was it even in Sarajevo? It wasn't. That game away to Bosnia. Amazing knee slide. Yeah, amazing knee slide through the fog. And he knew the only way he could be seen through the fog was to burst through it. Get low. Get low. Get underneath that.
Get underneath it. Yeah.
That fog stays high. Mm. I go, no, never mind.
There were also great goals by Wes Houlihan, who scored a quite bizarre lob. I don't know if you've seen it. About 35 yards. It seemed to have a very straight trajectory, but it was just high enough to be the goalkeeper before dipping in. That was for Norwich, obviously. Preston. Mm. Proud Preston. Scored had three Irish goal scorers, well, two Irish goal scorers, three Irish ghouls in the form of Aidan McGeady. He scored two very good ones, and then Daryl Horgan, who powered through the middle. Have you seen his effort?
Oh yeah,
he took a very he took like an early line. It kind of reminded me of almost a rugby move. he picked his line pretty early and just powered all the way through, and they couldn't quite get to him. And he finished it off well. So
McGeady's two goals were hilariously good.
No, there was a little bit of the Georgia second goal to his second goal yesterday. Sort of gets the ball, performs an elaborate series of feints and steps, and then knocks it into the top corner. So yeah, that was all very good. Obviously, the one for Burnley stopped Chelsea from extending their lead to 12 points.
What a great time to talk to Sean Dyche, literally the day after this.
Mm.
Good man, Richie.
Well, Sean Dyche and his...
See, I'm not afraid to praise Richie Murph.
The man who he's first among
very
equals.
Very big, yes.
First among equals in the Premier League, Dyche and Conte.
That was Keown. Martin Keown said that.
Yes.
The two best managers in the Premier League.
But Conte maybe a little bit dismissive, a bit sniffy about what happened. The pitch is small, and this is better for the team that has to defend and play this long ball. You have less pitch to cover, and then there is a good atmosphere with the supporters. And I think it's good. It's right to have this type of atmosphere at Burnley. And for all these reasons, they have all these points in the table. We put a lot of energy on the pitch today. We took only one point. We've found a team that thought to disrupt our football, to play this long ball, and to fight the second ball. So there is Antonio Conte, lightly patronising English Warriors, Burnley FC. Sean Dyche, not hugely impressed. Every manager has to give their opinion. He concedes. It's not a problem for me. It is interesting that Burnley are, I think, fourth in the home form table and bottom of the away table.
Yeah, they've only got one point away from home, I think.
One draw, 10 defeats away from home. But at home, they've got 29 points. So they're actually behind Leicester, but Leicester have played two more away games and got two more draws. So a win in one of their next two away games would see them ahead of Leicester in the away side. But it's a massive difference.
Yeah,
it really is a very pronounced difference. Does it have anything to do with the pitch, though? Well, when you compare Stamford Bridge the expansive home ground of Chelsea FC. He do play some fantastic football. You see that it's 103 metres by 67. And when you compare it to Turf Moor, the claustrophobic space of Burnley, who just like to get in. You know, like if you...
They're in on top of you, aren't they, Ken?
It's like fighting with a tramp in a wheelie bin, you know, playing at Burnley. So what were the Stamford Bridge?
Colourful phrase.
103 metres by 67, that's Stamford Bridge. Turf Moor, 104 metres by 66, which does give Chelsea a slightly larger playing area because their pitch is wider and that 1 metre width advantage extends for 103 metres of the length. But Burnley do have a longer pitch than Chelsea, adding up to two of actually the most similarly sized grounds in the league, with only Anfield coming in between those two. So I couldn't really say that the pitch was that much of a difference. But, you know, Antonio Conte just proved that he's good at coming up with reasons on the hoof as to why he didn't get the 3 points.
I like the fact that Dyche kind of didn't give that much legs, that strain of thought. Because he actually talked... See, I had Richie's interview today, Murphy. Just gave him a few bits of information on Sean Dyche. I thought he might like.
Interesting power play by you there. Just let the people know where the power really lies.
I remember having read the Michael Calvin book a couple of years ago. I mean, we've talked about that quite a lot, living on the volcano, about football managers. Sean Dyche is one of the managers interviewed, and he used a phrase about the rebranding or the debranding of managers. He says a lot of managers go in for this, and he calls it debranding, which means basically, you would think, you know, put it out there that this other manager, good result they got against our team today. It's just pity they had to resort to the long balls. So they start debranding, start making people think of you as less than what you actually are as a manager. Oh, it's just a long ball team. That's the brand. That's all that's left of it when a manager strips it away. He says he doesn't go in for it himself. And when other managers try it, he does his best to ignore it where possible. So yeah, he's probably done that here.
Well, he made the point after this game. He said, look, you've got to remember, we're a team everyone thought had no chance to get to where we are. I don't know if he's being disrespectful. He doesn't know all the work we do in the training ground. He doesn't know the depth of the analysis we use to get the players to perform. I don't expect him to know that. His job is to crack on with Chelsea. He's doing a blooming good job as well. But if we went into the Premier League and did what everyone else does, I don't think we would do it as well as them. So we do things that are different and strange. The brand of football I want to play is the one that wins. Every footballer wants to win. So trying to mix it up a little bit, give opponents problems that they're not familiar with, and at home, it does seem to work if they could crack the away side. Although it does look as though they
don't really have to.
They're pretty likely to stay up as it is. Yeah. And they're 10 points clear of relegation, and the way the teams in relegation are going, you don't see them closing the gap that fast. So without wishing to put the markers on them.
No, there are too many teams down there that would have to suddenly have a run. And they can't, even mathematically, it's hard for them all to have a run because they're going to be playing against each other quite a lot.
Mind you, Conte was having a few little pops at his team from other quarters. Jose Mourinho was offering the opinion that he doesn't think Chelsea will throw away this lead because they're such a defensive team that it kind of suits them to be out in front the way they are when you're such a defensive team and such a counter-attacking team. He said they defend very well with lots of players. And I think in this situation, a very defensive team wins the title with counter-attack goals and set-pieces goals. So I don't think they will let it slip, but football is football.
That's that debranding that Dyche was talking about.
A little bit of debranding. Chelsea have obviously scored, 13 more goals. Is it the Manchester United? They've scored a few more. Conte is saying, look, you know, I don't care. I know what Jose's doing. He's just having his little jokes. We'll leave that there. Mourinho himself, very happy after Manchester United's 2-0 win over Watford, which really could have been a lot more. Some of those games, but, you know, they were really ripping Watford to pieces in the first half. I mean, the few minutes leading up to the eventual opening goal by Mata had chance after chance from almost point-blank range. Zlatan missed a couple of quite easy chances throughout the game. They looked like they're going really well, as Mourinho said. It was very good, very good. I think it's the kind of football that if it wasn't a Mourinho team, if it's somebody else's team, you would say, art. But because it's my team, you just say it's very good, but that's fine.
Did you see the last like 30 seconds of Match of the Day on Saturday night?
No.
So everyone's agreed then. Manchester United on the march. They're looking dangerous. Wow, they're playing such great football. And then they flash the table up and Manchester United are still sixth. I mean, they were playing terribly in sixth. Playing quite well in sixth. Went on a bad run. Had a couple of bad results. Still sixth. Back playing sparkling football. Still in sixth place.
Yeah, but they are now only 2 points off second place, which is the big difference. I mean, they could conceivably be second with one win and some favourable results.
They just need to catch up with the rest of that peloton. They're cycling on their own at the moment. They're getting no help from anybody. They just need to latch on, get into a slipstream there of somebody.
Yeah. Mourinho had one other point to make, which was sort of an interesting one. He says, what I think you are forgetting this season is to say this is the most defensive Premier League that I've ever known. And it's not because of my team. Many, many, many defensive teams in the Premier League, more than ever, less English managers. And it's probably my seventh or eighth year in the Premier League. It's the most defensive I've ever had. Now, I'm not sure how he decides that the league is more defensive, but I guess one, maybe a crude marker for that would be, I mean, what pops
ghouls.
Into your mind?
Goals. And how many of them have been scored?
Total goals.
Total goals.
Well, not total goals, goals per game. We haven't finished the season yet. We don't know how...
Goals per game.
We don't know how total goals is going to end up. But goals per game, if you look at goals per game, this is actually the highest goals per game of any season since 1967-68. 2.82 goals per game. 67-68 was the last time it was over 3 goals per game in the top division in English football. And since then you had a big drop off. And since then, a kind of an increase. Actually, the two seasons when Jose won the title in 2005, it's 0.3 goals per game more than that. And 2015 and 2005, very similar, about 2.5 goals a game. And when he won it in 2006, it was the sixth lowest, 2.48 per game, sixth lowest out of 118 seasons. I would say it's hard to make the argument, or to sustain the argument, that this is the most defensive Premier League season ever. I wonder if he threw in that thing about the English managers as sort of to bait the hook a little bit, you know, because that's maybe a more popular point. You know, if you can put a spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down, you can maybe get your point out there. The lowest, incidentally, the lowest ever season in terms of goals per game in English football was weirdly just a couple of seasons after the most recent high point of 67-68. It was 1970-71. And the double was won by Arsenal Football Club, 2.3. But the one other thing Mourinho was saying was it's going to be difficult for us because they now have to play a bunch of like the League Cup final and Europa League and FA Cup and all this kind of stuff. So they don't actually play in the Premier League for a while now. And he says that the other teams will leave us. You know, basically there's going to be a gap again by the time we play in this competition next. He says, we play the Europa League, so let's enjoy that. We know in this moment Southampton are probably going to have some days off. I don't know if they go to a summer camp to enjoy some nice, beautiful place with nice weather to prepare for the final. The only thing I know is their next game is the final. We have to play 3 matches during this period. We have to train in this cold weather. We have to train on bad pitches. The weather doesn't help the pitches, so our situation isn't easy, but we have to enjoy it. So warm weather training for Southampton. Although... It just shows managers' opinions on this issue don't always match up. I saw David Moyes saying that he too was taking his players, his Sunderland players, away on a trip to train in a new environment. Although, unlike Southampton, or what Jose Mourinho expects Southampton to do, he's going to take them to freezing New York to run in the snow in Central Park. It's something different, says Moyes. It gives the players something to look forward to. We're going to watch basketball and ice hockey and go to Ground Zero. So culturally, I hope to educate the boys as well. The big thing for me, though, is to create team spirit. I want them to build relationships off of two. And the psychology behind going somewhere so cold is when we come back, we'll think Sunderland is Dubai.
You could just go to Dubai.
Or go to Siberia if you really want to feel warm when you get back.
Yeah.
This is interesting because this is the sort of... no upside, lots of downside managerial decision that when you're in the relegation zone is a really bad idea.
Well, who knows? He said he'd done it with Everton and it worked there. And who wouldn't like a trip to New York?
That is true.
Run in Central Park. It's not the It's not the worst setup, really, for the Sunderland players. So one of the big games over the weekend was Liverpool against Tottenham. And this is a very important win for Liverpool after what they've been through. In their first win of 2017 in the league, I think. And Mane obviously getting a couple of goals. And it's always sickening, I think, for Pochettino to see Mane doing these things, because he wanted to sign Mane and Daniel Levy decided he was too expensive. And Pochettino's already made the point to Levy after the Tottenham-Liverpool game at the beginning of the season, if we had a player like Mane, we would have won this game. by which he meant, if we had Mane, we would have won this game. Although Jorginho Wijnaldum, who also had a great game, there were some interesting comments actually from the Liverpool players after this, and they did a lot of talking after. It's usually Klopp who does most of the talking there. But on this occasion, Wijnaldum and Lallana both had a lot to say. Wijnaldum, first of all, was saying, don't just talk about Sadio Mane. He's important, but it's too much Sadio Mane now. He scored two goals, but also I think it's been about him because we had poor results without him. Before he left for Africa, we had good results. Still, they said, Sadio Mane, Sadio Mane. But last week we lost with Sadio Mane. I don't think it's fair to the other players to say, because of Sadio Mane, we win. Of course, he's a great player. He helps us with his speed and scores goals. But I think it is more about the team than only Sadio Mane.
You'd want to say his name a couple more times.
If it was another player, like when Phil was injured, if we had poor results, then everyone would have said, Phil Coutinho. You have to get used to it. But I don't think it's fair. He also said criticism kills the team. It's very important, basically, that Klopp didn't agree with all their media critics that they were, you know, not that good.
Pretty unusual for a player to talk about his teammate like that.
Well, look, it's a bit like, remember you were talking about Lallana before, and it was like people were saying, well, Adam Lallana, Jurgen Klopp really has shown you the way. You were a little lost sheep, and then he brought you back to the fold, and here you are, actually quite productive, you know? We'd given you up for lost. And he kind of seemed to bristle at it. Yeah. Oh, you know, he's a good manager, but you know, it's...
He hasn't changed anything.
He was given the credit this time to Jordan Henderson. He says, because Jordan Henderson called a meeting for a frank exchange of views to which Jurgen Klopp was not invited. And big credit to Jordan, says Adam Lallana. He wanted the team meeting to happen. He got everyone together. It wasn't just him who spoke. The senior players spoke, the non-senior players, everyone. It was good. It was refreshing. Just in the dressing room at Melwood, every now and again, it doesn't hurt to speak about it. Sometimes, if anyone has anything to say, as long as it's not personal, just purely professional, there's no harm in reminding each other what we need to do and what we want from each other. You could see everyone was fighting for each other. So whatever the reason for this, they did find their way out of it a bit. Although you can't really separate, I think, their win from Tottenham's really bad performance. I mean, it was the worst I've seen Tottenham play, certainly since they lost to Manchester United a couple of months ago. And you could see just the difference that a couple of important injuries make to a team. Tottenham lose Vertonghen and they lose Danny Rose. And they're just not the same Tottenham. They kept getting ripped open down what would have been Rose's side. And Pochettino, actually, I'm not sure what Wijnaldum would think of this, but he is very unforgiving of his team. You know, when they disappoint him,
he did seem furious, yeah.
Well, he says, if you start a game like we start, it's very difficult. It's difficult to fight for the Premier League if you show that lack of desire to play for a win. Which is, you know, it's not a case of, well, we had injuries, Liverpool played well, you know, mistakes happen. It's lack of desire. I mean, he also talked a bit about how they're trying to do the same job with different tools. Because Tottenham are not a team that's spending a lot of money at the moment because they're doing stadium or building a new stadium. So he did, if you compare Tottenham with the other teams competing with the top four, you should say, wow, Tottenham deserve a lot of credit for where they are now.
Except that the Leicester thing happened last year when Tottenham were in position to beat a team with much inferior resources and still couldn't do it. Beat a team to the title.
Well, why was that though?
Why did they not beat Leicester to the title?
Lack of...
Well, it was largely down to that result against Chelsea, wasn't it?
Yeah, but Pochettino...
Like a fight?
Pochettino slammed them after that and said, this team isn't ready to... This team showed to me that they're not ready for this. You know, I need to see more from them. Remember, it was didn't they lose 5-0 to Newcastle? Something ridiculous. You know, they'd obviously all given up. It was over. And they had this ridiculous result and Pochettino seemed like, you know, someone was really going to get badly punished for this. And... I mean, it seemed at that time doubtful that Tottenham would be able to recover. And actually they have. You know, the season that they've very much picked up where they left off last season, you know, after struggling a bit earlier, but they're going really well now. But Pochettino just showing that, like, you know, what you've done already, don't think of it as being in the bank. That's gone. You know, all that matters is what happens next. You know, he's very, very demanding.
Your final story in this edition of your report on Sporting?
Well, we should maybe we'll talk a little bit about what's happening in Germany, because did we mention the Dortmund Leipzig? We did when we were talking to Raphael Arnstein.
The attack on the Leipzig fans.
Yeah, and this kind of orgy of self-righteousness from the Dortmund fans, who had all these banners saying, well, all of these, like so many banners on the whole kind of big Süd Tribune, the massive stand they have, it was just covered in these things, messages taunting Red Bull Leipzig. For which they've now been told they have to play their next game with nobody on that wall. No, just a big empty concrete slab is going to be cheering them on for their next match. That's only for the banners, though. The actual violence and stuff is kind of, apparently the leaks as well, that's kind of more of a police matter. That's not really, but they have been punished for that. But there was another incident. This is a bizarre one. St. Pauli, the team from Hamburg, playing away to Dresden over the weekend. Now, Dresden had an important anniversary yesterday, which is the 72nd anniversary of the firebombing of Dresden during the Second World War. And the St. Pauli fans had a banner behind the goal. They're obviously the away team in this. And first of all, it said, look over there where they're still ploughing the fields with horses. They cordially invite you to their, you know, torchlit parade, which is basically an insinuation that the backward bumpkins supporting Dresden, you know, have sort of Nazi-ish sympathies. They then turned this over to reveal the message. Schon eure Großeltern haben für Dresden gebrannt, which means your grandparents already burned for Dresden, against the German Opfermythos, means kind of victimhood mythology, which is this idea, which is, it's referring to the fact that in Germany over the last, maybe since, you know, the mid kind of 90s, what happened in Germany after the war was obviously kind of denazification and a very conscious program of what they call coming to terms with the past, in which you know, everybody was taught in school, you know, a version of history, which is very rare in the world, a version of history in which we were the bad guys. You know, you don't tend to find this in national curricula around the world. It's usually quite a positive view of whichever country you happen to be in of their history. You know, in Germany that hasn't been the case, because the thinking was, this is something which we have to own this and have to try to retrain people into, you know, so people here aren't going to be vulnerable to sort of nationalist passions, you know, this idea that my country is always right, all the kind of problems that led to this big disaster that, you know, we know was the Second World War. But more recently, a kind of strain of history has emerged in which Germans are, or that concentrates on the victimhood of Germans during the war, that things happened like the bombing of Dresden, in which, you know, 25,000 people died in a night of incendiary bombings, which were war crimes, which the Germans were victims of. And there was, you know, many of these types of things, war crimes were committed by the Allies and Germans. So it's kind of challenging this notion of, you know, the Germans as having been the instigators. It's more a case of looking around and saying, well, nobody was innocent here, really, you know. Now, obviously, this is a kind of a thinking which is quite, it's more popular, let's say, on the right than on the left. So St. Pauli is like a famously kind of left-wing club. They're basically coming and saying, you idiots, Nazis here in the backward East are clinging to this nonsense. And they're basically saying, screw you. But obviously, they do so in a way which couldn't possibly really be more offensive. I mean, referring to your burning grandparents in the city. So obviously, you can imagine the reaction in Germany hasn't been too good. I don't know what the punishment for St. Pauli is going to be. And I also wonder how effective this type of argument is in advancing the point that they want to make, because I feel as though they probably alienate more people with that. I think it's probably a counterproductive way to go about making their point.
And so ends Kennedy's report on sport. What an ending.
Words, really. I'm over the moon. Emotional. It's unbelievable.
It's Stuttgart. It's New Jersey. They're all rolled into one. Another big, big scalp when it was needed most. Lyon, here we come.
Let's talk a little more about Leicester now and their what is increasingly looking like their plummet to the depths of the relegation zone. They're hovering around there now and may well go. We talked a bit about this last week. Jonathan Wilson is ready to chat now, though. Jonathan, Claudio Ranieri yesterday in particular, I think the body language looked pretty bad. He looked a little bit bedraggled post-match. He was asked in the press conference about whether or not he's been too loyal to certain players, and he pretty much said, well, yeah, I mean, I've given them a few chances this season, but you know, these are the guys. They got us the Premier League last year. Things not looking too good overall?
No, they're really not. I mean, it was a really poor performance. Sort of two really sloppy bits of defending to cost them the goals. And then, yeah, taking a look at half-time, Swansea could sit back and sort of hold them at arm's length. And they really, you know, barely threatened. And you sort of, there was one chance for Vardy, I think about 12 minutes ago, when the defence sort of opened up for him. And he screwed it miles wide. And you sort of think, well, last season he had the confidence, things like that were going in for him. And that, you know, wasn't even close to threatening a goal. He looked like a player he'd been playing non-league football 5 years ago. So yeah, the momentum is very definitely downwards, and I think they're right to be very concerned.
There's an amazing statistic about Vardy, which is that if you go back to when he scored in the 4-1 defeat against Liverpool, which is in September, he hasn't scored in 23 of the next 24 games he played. There's just a hat-trick against Manchester City in there and absolutely nothing else. I cannot remember a player of the year falling off a cliff like this before.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that the whole, it's not just Vardy, it's everybody at Leicester. This is unprecedented. I think that, you know, there's two issues there. One is, it's interesting the clubs that Vardy has scored against this season. That, yeah, he scored against Liverpool, scored the hat-trick against City. The teams who attack Leicester, teams who leave space behind them, you know, he can still do that. The issue is that other teams have worked out, you sit deep and he hasn't really got much. And just, you saw that.
Yeah, one thing on Jonathan, just before we get on to Vardy with this, because it's something that we have discussed over the last couple of weeks. How did teams not work this out in the middle of last season? Like, why did it take until this season to work out, oh, you just don't defend, if you defend deep, you're okay?
No, I think they did work it out last season. It was just that everybody was on such a high, there was such momentum behind them, that Vardy suddenly found himself able to execute things that were the very range of his skill set. Right. And now, because that confidence has fallen, he can't do that. And I think it's not just Vardy. I think that's true of Riyad Mahrez as well, who, you know, for all the criticism of Vardy, Mahrez has scored 3 goals this season when he got 17, I think it was, last season. Now, you know, I saw Mahrez at the Cup of Nations, and, you know, within 10 minutes of his first game in Zimbabwe, he scored describe to me a typical Mahrez goal. He gets the ball on the right, he drifts inside, and he curls it in off the far post. Exactly that goal. Defenses in the Premier League, no, you don't do that. And so that's been taken out of his game. And then when he stops scoring those sort of bread and butter goals, his confidence drops, and he's then not creating the chances for Vardy. Vardy's confidence has dropped. When he does get chances, like the one with 12 minutes to go, he snatches at it. So, you know, I think in the same way that last season was this sort of perfect storm of half a dozen players playing the best season of their lives, and Mahrez, I guess, would have hoped that that would be, you know, a staging post or something even greater. But players like Vardy or Wes Morgan or Robert Huth must have known that really that was as good as it's ever going to get. When you have that core of players all playing brilliantly, and then they all have a totally understandable dip, and just they fed off each other's confidence last season, so they're feeding off each other's lack of confidence this.
I mean, you say it's unprecedented, and to this extent it's unprecedented. I mean, Leicester haven't even scored in 2017 in the league in, is it five or six matches? I mean, it's a disastrous run. But there are some precedents. I mean, if you look back to the very first Premier League season when Leeds United finished 17th after winning the title the previous season. One thing that you notice when you compare Leicester and Leeds, and in fact Blackburn, who also had a really terrible title defence in 95-96, they ended up finishing 7th, but the start was just abysmal. They were out of the running after just a few weeks. One thing that you notice is this inability to do anything away from home. I mean, Leicester haven't won away from home all season so far. Leeds didn't win away from home at all in 92-93. Blackburn took until January to do it. Does that suggest that there's something about a sense of being uncomfortable with your status as champions, as though they were a little bit embarrassed of their status and sort of couldn't quite feel comfortable defending, as though they didn't feel they were worth it?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I think what's telling about those three examples, or you look back to, I mean, the worst ever title defence, Manchester City in 37-8 when they got relegated. And, you know, the only team up till now who have been relegated as champions. I mean, that was a very weird season in that they were top scorers and were still relegated. It was a very Manchester City thing to do. But, you know, that was the first time that City won the title in 36-7. Leeds had had that, you know, that long run since the Revy days. Blackburn had, you know, a long, long time since they've been champions. Leicester, the first time they'd ever been champions. So I think there's a very understandable... You know, they were all clubs for whom you could think, when they won the title, that's probably a one-off. You know, that's not coming off the back of sustained success. There might not be great success to come. Or you look at Ipswich when they won the league in 61-2. And, of course, it tends to get forgotten because Alf Ramsey went on to become England manager. But he was still in charge by, I think, February, March in 62-3 when he finally stepped down. And, you know, Ipswich were desperately struggling there near the bottom of the table. And the feeling with Ipswich was that they'd been found out, that they had this tactical trick of Jimmy Ledbetter, the left winger. They dropped him deeper and the fullback didn't know, should I follow him, should I not? And this is what Ramsey does with England, you know, with the wingless wonders that win the World Cup. He pulls those wingers back. And, of course, in the early 60s, it was much harder for opponents to work out what they're doing because he didn't have the saturation television coverage. So, you know, for Ipswich, it's a clear tactical reason. You look at Leeds, you could say maybe Cantona gave them that the last seven games when he came in, gave them that boost and he was gone, and maybe there was a... Tension between him and Harold Wilkinson.
They were sort of already gone by the time by the time Cantona left, which was in November. I think they were already, you know, completely falling apart. I mean, I don't know if what I'm saying is that they were already, the problem, whatever it was, started when Cantona was still very much there.
Yeah, but he'd fallen out with Harold Wilkinson and been all sorts of rumblings that summer that they'd started to tail off the end of 91-2. Benefited because United fell off worse, and then Cantona gave him just that little shot in the arm. But he scored three goals in his last seven games. So I guess what I'm saying is that there's a specific reason you can highlight for each one, but each of them, they were a team who weren't used to winning, who suddenly have this status thrust upon them. And whether that is intensified away from home, as you're suggesting, yeah, maybe it is. But I just think, you know, not just football, anything where you've quested for something for a long, long time and suddenly you achieve it, picking yourself up to go again is incredibly difficult.
Yeah, and if you look about it, a couple of the teams that we mentioned there, certainly the more recent ones, Leeds in the early 90s, Blackburn, neither of those clubs are in the Premier Division now and haven't been for some time in the case. Well, obviously, Leeds came back up and you know, had some good years after 92, 93. Blackburn, not so much. Would you be concerned about the future of Leicester if they do get relegated? Is there a fear that it's not as straightforward as they get relegated and they regroup and they just come straight back up, that they could end up getting a little bit sunk here in the next couple of years if they go down?
I mean, no more than you would be in a normal season. I mean, I guess the problem for Leicester is, what on earth is a normal season? Mm. That the defeat yesterday was 101st game since they got promoted. So the third season, 2 2/3 seasons near enough. Now, in those 101 games, they've picked up 143 points. Now, you average that out, 1.4 points per game. That's fine. You know, that's nice and mid-table. That's sort of 54 points a season. You're not going to get in the Europa League. You're not going to get relegated. If Nigel Pearson had done that every season and hadn't had all the other issues, then he'd still happily be in a job. The board would be happy with him, probably. You never quite know with boards, but the board should be happy with him. The fans would be happy enough with that. It's just that they took, of those 143 points, 103 of them came in a 47-game run, which got them to survival 2 seasons ago and then won them the league last season. So I don't know. I mean, I was trying to work this out yesterday. Whether is this just a very strange distribution of normal points? There's a mate of mine who's a West Ham fan who is a fellow at All Souls College, and sort of maths and philosophy is his thing. And he was one season, he was sort of very frustrated with West Ham and sort of felt that every game they played, they were playing a team who'd just come into form. So he tried to calculate this, and so he looked at every team, every game West Ham played, he looked at the opposition and their previous 5 games to see if it was an abnormal distribution. And he concluded that in this season, yes, they kept on playing teams who'd just won a couple of matches, who were on a high, who were clearly playing well. And he came to the conclusion that if a season was to be fair, if you were to even out these fluctuations of forms, everybody played roughly the same number. So you can have a reasonable expectation of everybody playing the same number of teams in form as out of form. A season would have to be 35 years long. So part of me wonders, is what's happened to Leicester? Is this just an extreme version of that? That, in 2.5 seasons, that's nothing like the 35 years you need to even it out. If they just had this incredible concentration of their own good form and maybe opponents' poor form, and we're now watching that even itself out. And if that is the case, is there any benefit in sacking Claudio Ranieri? Is there anything we need to be worried about? If they hadn't won the title last season, if they'd finished 12th, 13th, something that you'd expect from them, would you be particularly worried now? I mean, they've had a bad start of the year, but they're not in the relegation zone. I don't know. I just think perceptions are skewed by what happened last season.
Jonathan, say you were to put down the phone to us and then you were to go and make a cup of tea. Then your phone was to ring again. And it was to be on the other end of the line. Someone said, Mr. Wilson, I have an employment opportunity for you. Vichai Srivadana Prava, owner of Leicester City, requires a consigliere who knows the game to advise him on matters of major import.
A football man.
So you're flown down to Thailand. You're obviously put up in pretty nice accommodation and entertained. Then you're brought down for the audience with the Leicester City owner. And he says, Mr. Wilson, thanks for coming. Should I sack Claudio Ranieri? What do you tell him?
I don't know. How much am I getting paid? There's far bigger things than that. I think not.
You think not? When you look at Hull, who have appointed a manager who seems to know how to organise events, who certainly has made a quick impact. I mean, things are looking pretty good for Hull at the moment. And you see the kind of effect that can have. Would you not be a little bit worried that maybe, if this thing is finished with Ranieri, if they've already climbed the highest mountain and everyone knows nothing like that will ever happen again, maybe it's time to move on to the next chapter.
Well, maybe it is, but I think this is one of the huge problems that all teams in football have, which is nobody has any patience anymore. If we applied modern standards of how long you give a manager, Herbert Chapman would never win a league title with Arsenal. Bill Shankly would never win a league title with Liverpool. Matt Busby would never win a league title with Manchester United. Brian Clough would never win a league title with Nottingham Forest. Don Revie would never win a league title with Leeds. I think patience generally is a good thing. And I think even if Leicester go down, I think Ranieri has shown himself, not just with what he's done with Leicester, but over his career as a whole, as somebody who could bring them back. And you know, we seem to have this idea that, you know, as soon as somebody gets on a downwards drift, the thing to do is not to let them learn from that, not let them put that right, but is to get rid of them. That there's a sort of requirement for the blood sacrifice to give this sort of sudden boost that in the short term might keep them up, but to what long-term end? And I think it's a very dangerous precedent, and pretty much every club is guilty of this, of sort of saying to players, yeah, you know what, if things aren't going wrong, we're not going to blame you, we're going to blame the manager. So, you know, it's all right, I have three or four bad games in a row and we'll get rid of the manager, we won't have a go at you. And I suppose the way modern football is, the way that players move so regularly, maybe that is understandable, but I think it's detrimental to long-term tactical development. I think it's detrimental to any sense of unity and togetherness at a club. And that's what Leicester really had last season. And that's what made them champion. Right, one of the many things that made them champions against all odds.
Okay. Nice answer. Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers. Thanks.
That was one hell of a long question about placing Jonathan Wilson there, Ken, right into the middle of the brains trust at Leicester City.
Yeah. Tiger skin carpet. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really thought too many of the details. A chaise longue, in which the four golden legs are elephants. elephant heads, anyway.
And he says no. He says if he's in that room, if he's on that chaise longue, he's saying no, no boss.
No, he wouldn't be on the chaise. He wouldn't be on the chaise longue. Srivi Dhanaprabha would be on the chaise longue. Jonathan Wilson would be standing. I don't know if he'd be allowed to sit. I mean, he's only consigliere, not a trusted member of
the family.
He goes
to sit down and, Wilson, stand up.
Yeah.
Stand
Did
up
I
and
ask,
answer.
Yeah.
I,
ask you to
I just asked you, should we sack Ranieri? And said no.
He says no. Which, yeah, I mean, I see where he's coming from. I mean, it would seem, as he says, to what end? You know, okay, maybe he'd stay up, but is it the right thing to do? No, probably not. But I suppose that short-term goal of how are we going to actually stay in this league? I mean, how important it is, I'm not sure. I mean, there was an article by Scott Murray during the week or last week in which he made the point that, look, if Leicester actually get relegated, it only adds to the mythos of what they achieved by winning the league. You know, it actually will draw, it's the kind of thing that will draw attention to their title win in 100 years' time. You know what I mean? It will be like, this really was, truly, this was the greatest story ever told.
I think that's already going to be there.
Yeah.
Regardless of imminent relegation or immediate relegation. But one of the teams who may send them down ultimately is Hull City. Miguel Delaney was there to see them play Arsenal at the weekend. They were beaten this time, Miguel, but played quite well again by all accounts. And they have this manager, Marco Silva, in place now who seems to be doing well. You saw this guy close up. Was he an impressive character?
Yeah, he was. And I think the team were impressive even in defeat because, in contrast to Leicester, I was at the Leicester United game the previous week. And Leicester are actually good for 40 minutes, but then once they conceded, they completely collapsed. And that is the opposite to Hull, who were actually not at their best first half. Kind of, they've been, obviously, one of the impressive things about Silva is that they've been so defensively resolute. Whereas in the first half of this game, Arsenal were puncturing holes and it did feel like a goal was coming. But once they actually conceded what was a controversial goal as well, they rallied and looked probably the better team in the second half. And they do have to. They do seem to have that. He's already instilled a certain character in them. The very fact that, I mean, anyone would presume the game was gone that once the bigger team had gone ahead and once a team like Arsenal at home, but it wasn't. And I think Arsenal was somewhat fortunate to come away with a badly needed win in the end. Well, but Silva, he was impressive enough in his press conference. Interesting, actually, one of the things where you really get a flavour for a manager in those situations is the usually after a Saturday game. They'll do a bit for the Monday papers, and it's usually kind of five or six journalists, and they're a bit more chatty and things like that. But Silva didn't on Saturday. He was straight out of there, did his main press conference, and went. So we didn't get to see him too up close.
Yeah, I mean, he's a manager who has won before at the Emirates. He was the manager of the Olympiacos side that won 3-2 there about a year and a half ago. So you know, he's kind of been there, done that. Unlike, I guess, his predecessor in the job, Mike Phelan. What are the differences though between this team and Phelan's team? Because it seems as though they actually now have a really good chance of getting out of this. Which at the beginning of the season, after they'd had such a shambolic summer, they had started the season with like 14 players or something ridiculous. Nobody had given them a chance.
Well, also it seems that no matter what player is in that team, and like they have had some turnover of even the short time that Silva's been there, They've had some turnover of players, and yet the level has stayed constant and probably gotten better. We actually asked Wenger about this on his, at his Thursday press conference, and what he gave Silva a bit of praise, obviously the Olympiacos match was brought up, well, he gave Silva a bit of praise. He was a little bit chippy about it, kind of going, they were playing well under Mike Phelan, you know, as if kind of the ingredients were there. You know, talking to people that know kind of the whole setup and that, apparently one of the things he's apparently been really good at, Silva, is that he's a little bit Conte-like, if not as intense, in terms of how he positions players everywhere, particularly in defence, I suppose, is what Hull have needed. But I think more importantly what they've said is that when they do go behind, or when, I suppose, the quote-unquote game status, or the kind of terminology would have, it changes when there's a goal, he prepares them for a lot of different situations. And that's probably one reason why, beyond kind of notions like character, resilience and all that, that they have been so rigorous and so well-prepared once they have gone behind in games like Arsenal.
Yeah. The big thing that's been going on there, obviously, at Arsenal is this questions over what Arsene Wenger's intentions are. Ian Wright last week, yeah, blabbed that he had been talking to Wenger in some private capacity, and Wenger had told him, "Righty, I think this could be the end."
No, Righty. that wasn't on the record.
But Wenger, I think, has dismissed that as...
I was just talking shite to Ian Wright.
Ian Wright doesn't know what he's talking about. But it does seem as though this is a bit of a question. It's not just Ian Wright. It's there's a few people there who... How do you gauge the situation at the moment regarding Wenger's own thoughts?
Well, it was I felt a little bit central to that, because earlier that day, I'd actually been on a show with Ian Wright in for one of the Premier League things about 5 hours before he did BBC. And he was talking about it then as well. And I was kind of thinking to myself, This is a bit of a news line here, only from, of course, to say it himself publicly. But he was talking about the whole incident, and there was a little bit of a slip up, I thought, from Arsenal on Saturday about that, because the spin on what Wright said was then suddenly, oh no, this was it was an event for Arsenal's Diamond Club, which, you know, the high paying members, but it was in a room of 500 people, and that's where all this came. But then at his press conference after the game, Wenger was directly asked, you know, so you weren't with Wright in any sort of private setting? Oh no, yeah, we had dinner. It was me, Wright, and three or four other people. And obviously that's where a lot of Wright's impression came from. I think, as he said himself in Match of the Day, it was a fair impression, because I was at his press conference on Thursday, and just Wenger's mood was so bad. But on Saturday, by contrast, after they've won, he had that kind of, you know, elation that comes with that kind of relief. And he did call it relief at the win. And I imagine if he'd asked him about his future then, he would have been much more positive about it. Because this is the thing with Wenger, talking to people that know him well, it's like he's still so utterly absorbed by every single performance, every single result, that his mood, and particularly his mood to do his future, is almost completely dictated by the last 90 minutes of football. And this is probably going to be kind of an ongoing theme for the rest of the season. The pendulum probably swing results. And I think that's why, you know, Arsenal fan responses, because apparently he is, quote, aware of Arsenal fan TV, although doesn't watch it and probably wouldn't publicly acknowledge it. And also where they finish in the league, how they do in the Champions League could dictate a lot of this as well. But a lot of people that know him say, I mean, first of all, no one close to him knows what he's thinking, apparently. He hasn't given any indication whether he's made any decision, bar, you know, kind of dropped phrases like with Wright the other night. But, you know, even as apparently as a commercial representative, they're kind of all... They don't know what's going to happen, which is quite a remarkable situation for a club of that resources, that it's so open like this, and there hasn't been more pressure to sign. But a lot of people that do know him, despite this fear that he might go with all this, when it comes right down to it, the thought is basically that this is a guy whose only interests are football and hard news, current events. And like, to unwind after, you know, bad defeats, he just watches more football. He watches a lot of kind of European leagues, particularly German, French. So when it comes right down to it, can you really imagine Wenger kind of saying, "Nah, I can do without that"?
Absolutely not. I cannot imagine Arsene Wenger deciding voluntarily to leave the job. The job is him.
Completely. And I think, because this is a guy that he loves the everyday. And even people have said how he might go to PSG or something like that, or take some sort of director role elsewhere. But there's still that break in the job. For a guy that is consumed by the job, probably even more than Alex Ferguson in that sense. I mean, he had that famous quote about Fergie a few years ago. You know, well, he has his horses, so he's enjoying his life. Whereas you don't think Wenger has that release in that sense. This is a guy that he's absolutely consumed by it.
Miguel, I've got the big game tomorrow against Bayern, and I'm just googling Wenger Ozil here. The headlines: yeah. Mesut Ozil kicked locker in front of Arsene Wenger after Man City game. Arsenal boss Arsene Wenger lays into Stars form after poor performance against Hull. Wenger weighs up dropping Ozil for Bayern clash. That'd be a pretty big statement to drop certainly your second best player, maybe after Alexis Sanchez.
That was a piece I did in the Independent today. Not that he's considering dropping him for the Bayern clash there, but that I'd heard that Wenger in the last 2 months, like, apparently Wenger gets as frustrated with Ozil as anyone, and has wanted to drop him, and some even Arsenal players. You know, they get frustrated because they think Ozil more than anyone almost gets away, quote unquote, with subpar performances without any real punishment. But I think part of the issue is that, and why he hasn't dropped him, A, because he does see this effect of incidents like that, you know, kicking the locker at Manchester City. And it's quite an odd thing with Ozil that you see him on a pitch sometimes, and the way he just doesn't get involved in incidents that, like, you know, and people go on about how, you know, playmakers shouldn't. You know, they should save themselves for moments where they can produce and all this sort of thing. It's not his position to tackle. But, like, if you're a natural competitor, if there's a challenge to be made right beside you, you're probably going to do it. And there's so many moments when Ozil doesn't. The Ashley Williams header against Everton being the clearest example. So it's difficult to square that with the apparent reality that this does get at him. That when he can't affect games, it does really frustrate him. So Wenger knows all that and knows it gets to Ozil, and he's you know, consciously trying to fix it. But secondly, they arguably don't have an obvious replacement. I mean, Iwobi could go there, but he's maybe a bit too inexperienced to play the primary playmaking role. And Sanchez could go there. But I think with the way Arsenal play, it would almost require a bit too much of a reshuffle in terms of, like, the direction they play. Because, you know, Alexis just gets the ball and goes for it. I remember talking to someone at Barcelona before who was just talking about why Alexis couldn't... it didn't really happen for him there. And one reason was, particularly why it didn't really happen under Guardiola. And one reason, because Guardiola, obviously, with a player like that, when one of the attackers gets a ball, their first instinct should be to stop, pause, and look, you know, to have that kind of awareness. Whereas Sanchez's first instinct is always to get it and just run and go for it, and, you know, and attack. And obviously what Ozil does is much more kind of nuanced than that. There's much more pause to it. He's, you know, looking for angles. So, you know, the switch from one to the other would maybe too great, and for that reason, Wenger probably hasn't pulled the trigger on Ozil yet in terms of his team selection.
Well, we'll see what happens tomorrow. Miguel, brilliant, thanks a million.
Cheers, lads.
See, if you don't get this out with Motherwell, you're away, mate. Your bags in your desk, boom.
I mean it, I'm fucking raging, speaking from my heart. Who would I want in? I've got big Terry Butcher in.
Mr. Tate, how you doing?
Not too good after tonight. You got the job on the technicality of a legend who recommended you.
Take no beep, I take no beep, I take no, I take no, I take no beep. Just so soft, don't try to get so deep. You know me, but I can't yell me, I can't yell me, I can't yell me, I can't yell, can't yell, can't yell me.
You have lost the fans tonight. You don't deserve the fans.
Listen to fans. You just need to fucking work on it.
You are nothing. You are a fool, and you are a waste of time. Good night.
Oh, the Guinness Book of Records. Stop. Get a grip.
He's your biggest fool in Manchester.
Poor old Arsene Wenger. Obviously, the criticism has been coming in from all corners. And some particularly stinging words came out of the mouth of Garth Crooks over the weekend. He was speaking on BBC Final Score.
I've got some really big concerns, and they've gathered over a number of years. First of all, when he actually pushed Alan Pardew, very unusual, out of character. It happened again with Martignol, and then again with Jose Mourinho, and then with the referee or the fourth official. For me, these are signs that there's something happening here with Arsene Wenger as he's getting old. The pressure may be getting to him a little bit, the judgment gets a little more impaired, he's getting older.
He's getting frustrated, Garth, but that's three incidents in 20 years. Three incidents of discipline in 20 years. Maybe one is too many, it's about frustration.
Great, Bill Shankly, Brian Clough never pushed officials or other opposition managers. Don't tell me about managers and what they should do. I've seen great managers never behave like this. There is a code of conduct. And what this is indicating to me is here is a man under pressure. Now, I understand it's a pressurised game, but at one stage, when he pushed that fourth official, I thought, it's time for you, Austin, to take a break from the game.
Yeah, Brian Clough, undoubtedly great manager. Again, not sure he'd be the man I'd cite when you're trying to argue that managers back in the day didn't resort to violence.
He did punch one of his own fans. I mean, I'm not misremembering this.
He punched one of his fans. He punched at least one of his players, Roy Keane.
Hmm.
Yeah, he decked Roy Keane. He punched the fans. I mean, there was lots of other.
I suppose they're not. He didn't punch a referee, so maybe, strictly speaking, the comparison is accurate.
Yeah, aggressions, micro and macro. I mean, the other thing is that the thing with Martin Yall and Alan Pardew, they both happened in 2006. You know what I mean? So Arsene Wenger is nearly 11 years older than that now. And he's always kind of been doing, when he said it's out of character, it's in character. Arsene Wenger was supposedly going to be banned for 12 matches in 2000 when Arsenal played at Sunderland. Patrick Vieira got sent off. Darren Williams was a Sunderland player who had basically, he pulled Patrick Vieira's shirt and Vieira swung a lordly arm, nearly took his head off. The referee, he was just swatting him aside. You know, Patrick Vieira, when you're Patrick Vieira, you have the right to sort of mark out your personal space. The referee sent him off. And Wenger waited in the tunnel for the officials. And then, you know, by all accounts, you know, there was a bit of, I don't know if an attack would be putting it too strongly.
But it would be more the sort of behaviour more at home in the Tyrone Senior Football Championship than in the Premier League.
Yeah, it was Wenger was supposedly waiting then for Darren Williams, the man who'd been involved in the thing. The two were head to head, was the report. So, you know, butting each other with the sort of the contact headbutt type of thing, not swinging the head violently, but pushing
the 4-inch headbutt.
Yeah, and that was, you know, only 4 years into his career at Arsenal. You know what I mean?
He's not unraveling in his old age, which seems to be suggested by Garth Crooks.
Losing control.
He's acting how he always acted.
It's what Wenger always did. Some people here need to learn how to lose. That was what Bobby Robson said in 2001. And, you know, 16 years later, we're still waiting.
We've got another podcast out today. That's Monday. It's going to feature Six Nations Chat with Shane Horgan and Martin Williams and lots more besides. You can listen to that whatever way you get this show. That is available to everybody. To get the daily podcasts from tomorrow, Tuesday to Friday, including Richie's Sean Dyche show, please sign up to the Second Captains World Service at secondcaptains.com. We're very, 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 very excited about this. Even if you're not going to get involved, you should, if you have time, you should go on secondcaptains.com and have a look at the new site. Lots of cool stuff there, including videos from the Liberty Hall Theatre show late last year. Some great stuff there. To those of you who are members already, thanks so much for being so quick off the mark. You should have a little welcome mini podcast in your feed right now. Thanks, Ciarán.
Thank you, Owen.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Ciarán. Thank you all.
Thanks for listening. You're amazing.
Talk soon.
Is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, they never go home, they never go home, those boys.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.